stand up, don't give up the fight. Preacher man, don't tell me. Good morning, good morning. I'm Dave Mazza, and you're listening to Voices from the Edge. Joanne is taking a much-deserved break this week, but she will be back next week joining us at the table again to talk about what's important here in this community. So, we're going to have a great show, but before we get into the actual show, I do want to remind folks that this is Walt Curtis Week. And for those of you who are saying, why is this Walt Curtis Week? Well, for one, because Mayor Adams proclaimed it as such, the week of July 1st through the 7th is Walt Curtis Week. And it's partly to honor Walt's many contributions as a writer and artist and just a general cultural presence here. But more importantly, too, we're trying to do a lot of work to help Walt because in a recent fire at the Great Northwest Bookstore, Walt lost most of his writings and works. And while he's not really been letting that get to him, it would be great to sort of help him out. So there's a whole variety of things coming up this week, including events at Barbati's Pan and at Dante's and et cetera. And you need to log in at kbo.fm to check it out and find out why we're all celebrating Walt Curtis Week. So make sure you check that out. That's really important to do. Walt's been a great presence here at KBOO for a number of years, as well as in the broader community. Well, let's get on to what's going to be, I think you're going to find, an interesting hour. We are going to be spending this morning talking with someone who's had a tremendous impact not only on Oregon's politics, but on a variety of social justice movements beyond that reach well beyond Oregon. My guest this morning is Oregon Supreme Court Justice Betty Roberts, first woman to serve on Oregon's Supreme Court. She's also a former state legislator, lawyer, teacher, and now adds memoirist to her list of accomplishments because she's just written With Grit and By Grace, Breaking Trails in Politics and Law, a memoir of the many things that she has achieved in her life and some very insightful observations on the struggle of women and others to gain their place at the table, and also just a general look at how politics are. So, as always, we want you to join us in the conversation this morning by giving us a call at 503-231-8187. I was just having one of those moments again where I nearly gave up my cell phone, and while I love to talk to folks, I prefer we do it through the studio. So, 503-231-8187. Well, Justice Roberts, thank you very much for joining us this morning.
Thank you for having me here, too. Appreciate it.
And again, there's a lot of things we can we hope to cover today, and particularly want to spend some time with your memoir, which I'm looking forward to reading thoroughly, but just barely dipping my toes in the water, found it to be an incredibly direct and honest piece of writing, which many memoirists do not do. So I think congratulations on achieving that. But let's start first. I'd like to talk about something that's a little more topical, and you have a special perspective on this, having been seated as a Supreme Court justice here in Oregon. And I'd like to talk a bit about what's going on with the Kagan nominations and get your sense on both the process and what you see about the nominee herself in terms of her, taking a seat on the court.
Dave, my first impression about the hearings, not about her personally, but about the hearings, is that for the first time in ages, we have a nominee who has not been a judge. And I discovered, to my great appreciation, that the committee members didn't resort to the code words that we often hear when they're talking to former judges or judges who are moving on up to the Supreme Court or any of the federal positions. Code words like judicial activist and judicial restraint, original intent, all those things that sort of go over the heads of average citizens who are saying, well, what's that and what are they talking about? But she wasn't a judge. And so the first thing that came to me when they started talking with her, that here is a nominee that we're really going to learn something about personally.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we did. I think we have. I mean, she wound up her testimony yesterday. Of course, they can call her back sometime, but today they're hearing other witnesses, both pro and con, her nomination. That was one thing that first struck me. Secondly is that she has a very good paper trail, not in court decisions, but in her work for the Clinton administration and the hundreds, probably, memos that she wrote on issues, making recommendations. So there, we got into the committee and who we call General Kagan, because she's Solicitor General, first woman there, was the first woman dean of the Harvard Law School, and they could talk to her about issues, and she could explain why she wrote that memo, what the background was of the facts, what the issue was, and I found it a good debate between her and the committee members.
You said that you felt that we learned significant things about her through this process. What were some of the points that, you know, what were some of the significant points that came out to you as you were listening to this?
Well, of course, the committee members come from one viewpoint, political viewpoint, Democrats from another. The Republicans, of course, were looking to challenge her on those recommendations to a Democratic president. And she sent him memos on the late-term abortion issues, on other issues that he asked her advice on. And, of course, they also got into the issue of don't ask, don't tell, mm-hmm. that she took a stand on when she was dean of the Harvard Law School. There were just many of, and she's argued before the Supreme Court cases. So they started talking to her about the United Citizens case, the one more recently that the court has decided that corporations are a person for the purposes of political contributions, and that therefore they can have their, quote, free speech by making those contributions. Sort of overturning some precedent there. And so we're now talking about conservative activists and liberal activists.
Mm-hmm.
We've got them on both sides. You want to go forward, you want to go back. And I just found it very important in terms of the public hearing her position.
Well, I know one of the fundamental arguments taking place during the nominations process, of course, is the question of how one interprets the Constitution with the conservatives, and especially many of the conservative justices on the court, arguing that one has to operate from the framework of the mind of the writers of the Constitution, as opposed to...
That's the original intent.
Original intent,
term.
Exactly. And
who can determine that?
Well, that's what I was just going to say. I think for the layperson, that seems to be kind of, you know, I mean, on one hand, I know some people think, well, that seems easy enough, but it seems like when you're sitting on that bench, how do you actually do that?
Well, I don't know, because I didn't. You know, that's not that I respect, as all judges, all people in our country do, respect the Constitution. We want to learn about how it was written and why it was written. And there are, of course, some writings, primarily from James Madison, who kept extensive notes and wrote, but others too, about the intent of those individuals and what they were putting into the Constitution. But the Constitution has also been amended since then, and the courts have interpreted since then those intents. And my position is that the courts have to have a certain amount of consistency for stability and for predictability. for the public and for lawyers, that they know what the law is, they know how to operate with that law. On the other hand, society changes. And I don't know, for example, Brown versus Board of Education that was decided in the mid-1950s that said schools had to be integrated, that separate but equal was not equal. And that was a departure, but it's made history. And would we change that now? Would we go back to what it was before Brown versus Board of Education? It's always a balancing act, and it's always an analysis. So oftentimes, the reasoning in a case is more important than the outcome. And than the actual decision. And that's what lawyers do. They look for the reasoning.
I think that a lot of people, particularly with the recent ruling affecting campaign contributions, and now the one that just came down involving McDonald versus Chicago, I think it is, regarding Second Right Amendments on possessing arms. Some people are saying, well, you know, the Supreme Court just got it wrong. And they, you know, argue that there's lots of instances where the courts just, you know, really got it wrong. And yet they have these tremendous impacts as a result of these decisions. And how do you on the bench, how do you deal with that? I mean, you know, in some ways, If Congress passes a law and it's really wrong, there's the chance to come back and fix it. The Supreme Court makes a decision, and if they get it wrong, it can last.
And it probably will. That mm-hmm. case probably will last for a long time. It'll take some unusual circumstances, perhaps, for the court to say, wait a minute, we didn't mean in this kind of a circumstance. Mm-hmm. So then it's maybe a gradual change, not a total reversal, but interpreting the facts in one way or another, but only as to that case, perhaps.
Mm-hmm.
Different judges, you know, handle all these in different ways, and that's what makes the law interesting, and that's what makes the court procedure interesting.
Before we move on here. The other piece I think that keeps coming up, particularly in the press, and I think a lot of people wonder about that, is that there are in all these nomination hearings, it's become far more common for the nominee to decline to comment on specific cases, saying because they may come up again. And many people would say, well, you know, don't we want to know, have some idea of how they feel about this particular issue before somebody makes a decision on it? And where do you draw that line between potentially jeopardizing the nominee, you know, the judge's objectivity on an issue and really, you know, letting people be fully informed before they decide whether this person is qualified to take on those responsibilities?
Well, there are some issues, and some of these were put to Elena Kagan by the committee members. That she had to say that about. She said, this issue may come before me. And that's not a cop-out. That is, we don't want her to say anything. Cases go to the court to the appellate courts from many different perspectives, postures, I would say. What happened at the trial level? And then what are the issues that are presented on appeal? So a judge couldn't say, for example, well, if this case came before me, I would rule this way or that way, because that may not even be the issue. It may be a procedural issue. It might be an issue that no one has ever thought of before. And so that person, the nominee, cannot predict how a case will come up, and should not make any comments, general statements, comments. That's a political statement. How do you feel about gun control? How do you feel about abortion? How do you feel about campaign contributions? What if this case came before you? What would you do with it? Well, that's a question for our state representatives and for our congresspeople to decide. That's, you can say, if a proposal is made in Congress on this or that, how do you feel about this? And what will you do? But not for judges. Not for judges, because there's too many factors involved about how a case gets to the court.
Well, if you're just tuning in, you're listening to Voices from the Edge. I'm Dave Mazza. Joanne is taking the week off, but we'll be back next week. And I'm talking this morning with Oregon Supreme Court Justice Betty Roberts, who's with us this morning to talk about, well, we've been talking about the Kagan nomination process, but we also are going to move on and talk about there are many remarkable things she's done and contributions to Oregon and the country, as well as her new memoir, With Grit and By Grace, Breaking Trails in Politics and Law. And if you want to join us in the conversation, give us a call at 503-231-8187. I'm sure that Elena Kagan may be feeling that it hasn't been a cakewalk for her. I mean, they've some fairly intense grilling, but and your situation being at the state level is somewhat different. But are you seeing any similarities in terms of the what you had to go through to end up on the bench of the Oregon Supreme Court? And
well, only that when I was on the Court of Appeals as the first woman there before I went to the Supreme Court. And so I was appointed to the Court of Appeals in 1977 by then-Governor Robert Straub, Bob Straub. I did not have the background, certainly, that Elena Kagan has. And she has a fantastic legal experience background, both in practice. She clerked for Justice Marshall, Thurgood Marshall. She and she was a law professor along with being dean at Harvard Law School, and then her work in partisan political affairs. So my background is political, of course, but I had 10 years of practice and a pretty active practice, general practice, and I felt that my legislative experience, which would be similar to her experience, Lana Kagan's experience in politics, that my experience in the legislature compensated for any maybe court work that I could have been doing while I was there. You work with the law. You work with statutes constantly. And you know what the issues are. And much of the legislation that passed during those Tom McCall years that I was in the legislature, came to the courts, certainly land use legislation, consumer protection legislation, and I knew the legislative background of those issues. So there is some similarity, and she's getting this by an appointment. I got mine by appointment. In the state, we don't have to go through the confirmation process. But at the federal level, we do because of a constitutional provision. So there are some similarities, and I relate to that. I think the one thing I do want to say, Dave, is that I relate most to the fact that she's a woman.
Well, I was going to lead up to that because there is the fact that, yeah, I mean, and I'm curious, do you see that despite, and we always have to discount the Fox News crowd because they find a whole variety of bizarre reasons to object to people. But do you find that some of the hurdles that you were having to overcome through that process, because first woman on the appellate court, were there attitudes and opinions that were present then that you had to confront that you're not seeing play out so much here in the Kagan situation?
I think so. I think that my hazing days early on as the junior judge there at the Court of Appeals was part of the problem. Part of the problem also was that some members of the court thought that I would bring a political agenda to the court. Let me speak to that just a moment, because Elena Kagan has been accused of this too, saying that, that she's too political, that she's going to take it along with her to the court. She won't. for her own good. She won't. She knows that. She's a smart woman. That if she goes there and says, I'm going to get this done or this done through this case on a political basis, she'll be marginalized by all the other judges. They will learn that. And she won't be effective. She won't be able to influence the other judges. No one wants to do that. You want to work with your colleagues, bring them along, be a consensus builder where you can, and try to get as many judges with you on an opinion as you can. And to take a political agenda along to the court is self-defeating. And she knows that. So it's not going to happen. She's going to look at every case very objectively.
Do you feel that because, as you've mentioned, you came out of this through the legislature and practicing law as opposed to spending, being on the bench at all, do you think that brought you strengths that the judge who's kind of been on the same track of working his way up through the various positions in the judiciary or has, a law school kind of academic background, do you think that you brought different strengths?
I did.
The immersion in politics made you a different, but perhaps in some ways better,
I think
judge?
Yeah, I think it made me, I don't know whether this is the right word to use or not, but more of a practical approach to the cases. Look at them, what's this problem, what's the issue, let's get on with solving it. And therefore, I worked quite efficiently from that standpoint because I was used to hard work and used to analyzing the problems that we were facing in the legislature. The courts need to be diversified more than they are today. And I do want to say this before we get into the telephone calls here, is that the fact that we have now had the fourth woman appointed to the U.S. Supreme Court, there will be three women sitting on that court at one time, is a sight I never thought I'd see in my lifetime. And it's very moving. It's very important to all of society. But the fact that it is happening now, one-third of the court, there are few courts in this country that can say that. Multnomah County is an exception in the trial court level here. One half of the judges in Multnomah County are women, and that's very unusual. I mean, it says something, I think, about the governors who appoint them and the people who run. And I find, and speaking of people who run for the judge position, I think the public is very receptive to women being on the courts. They see them as fair, and I hope that continues. And good listeners, good to work with people, juries, witnesses, lawyers who come before those trial courts. So there's a lot of advantage there. We have a long ways to go. Women do, certainly minorities, even further to go. But I think this is an important time in our history when we can say our top court in this country is made up of one-third women.
No small accomplishment in light of the history of the 200 years or more of the court of what it's been. Well, we're going to go to the phone lines because we have some callers who have been waiting. And again, if you just tuned in, you're listening to Voices from the Edge. I'm Dave Mazza. I'm speaking with Justice Betty Roberts. We've been talking a lot about the Kagan nomination process, but we're also getting into a little bit about her remarkable life and contributions to Oregon. If you want to give us a call, give us and join the conversation, call 503-231-8187. We're going to go to the phone lines where we have Stevie Ray on the line. Good morning.
Hey, how are you guys doing this morning?
Good, good.
I was wondering if Justice Roberts, can I still call you that?
Yes, of course.
You were referring to land use and consumer protections and things, and I've been really interested in renewable energy sources for a while, and I just recently came across some information about how Oregon allows industrial-grade hemp production. for maybe pulp and paper uses and maybe some fiber clothing or ropes. But also, it seems, with that focus, the side effect of the process is the seed oil, which it burns so clean in a diesel engine, and it doesn't have that fingernail polish in your fuel line the way that ethanol does. I would like you to speak on that, please. Please. Thank you.
Well, you know, I'm sorry. I'm going to have to pass on that issue. You're very well informed. I can tell that. And I'm not. I'm not in the legislature, and I'm not dealing with those issues. And I'm afraid that you could teach me some things rather than for me to make comment.
Thank you, Stevie Ray. Well, let's go on to our next caller. Good. Oh, well, we'll hold off for a minute on that. I'm getting a little ahead of myself. But let me go back to our caller. I mean, one of the problems that advocates for uses involving hemp and what have you is, of course, trying to reconcile taking action at the local level and changing the law and running up against federal restrictions. And that, of course, brings to mind that relationship between state and federal.
States' rights, one of those code words.
Right, which, you know, oftentimes, you know, yeah, the code word brings all sorts of very unpleasant images and concepts to mind, and yet perhaps, you know, around issues like, you know, environmental protection, it almost seems like states' rights is something that needs to be put forward. How do you reconcile that?
A certain amount of responsibility should be in the states, as far as I'm to the states, who are local, who know the issues, and who can address the issues. Federal law is intended to make the law uniform and to apply to all the states. And as far as the drug use is concerned, there's been the attempt to make the federal law supreme over the states. I also think of the Death with Dignity Act that we had here, or it was an initiative that was passed, and that most Oregonians are very protective of that. And yet there were attempts a few years ago in Congress to say that's unlawful. And I can just imagine if they had passed that legislation in Congress, what Oregonians would have done. You know, we would have been very unhappy about that. And it would have been challenged on whether or not states have that issue. So you find very many cases going to the court, to the U.S., all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court on the issue. How far can states go in terms of regulating drug use for medical purposes in Oregon? That's an issue now. And when does the federal government take over and make the decision for us? That's the old debate between federalism and anti-federalism. Mm-hmm. We go back to the founding fathers. Unfortunately, no women there, who wrote the Constitution. And so the court has to address that in each issue. And it's an issue that we're going to see all the time, forever, in a federal system, because the federal system gives certain rights to the states. 10th Amendment says all rights not in the Constitution are reserved for the states. So that's the federal system set up there, and those issues will be with us forever, I suspect.
Well, we're going to go back to the phone lines now, and if you want to join us in the conversation, give us a call at 503-231-8187. We're talking this morning with Oregon Supreme Court Justice Betty Roberts, and we got Joe on the line. Good morning, Joe.
Good morning. Your Honor, I have a question about a recent Supreme Court decision which ties in with what you've been saying here. The Oregon Supreme Court recently made the decision that employers can fire employees if they provide a urine sample that has THC in it, and it doesn't matter if it's been prescribed medically by a doctor. Now, this legislation was put forward by the citizens of Oregon by the initiative process, and it was passed by the legislators. Now, I understand that sometimes legislators can override citizens' initiatives. Case in point, twice the Sarah Palin Alaska State Legislature overrode the intent of the citizens of Alaska, whereby they were saying that wolves should not be shot by aircraft. So we know that state legislatures can do this, but the legislature of Oregon did not block this. So, in a matter of speaking, jointly by way of the intent of the citizens and the intent of the state legislature in allowing for this, we are allowed to have medical marijuana prescribed by doctors. Mm-hmm. Along comes the Supreme Court and said, no, we don't think so. It just seemed to be a really rather extremist, right-wing, politically driven decision. I thought there was just contempt shown for the people of Oregon. I'm wondering what your feelings are about this.
Well, my first response is that the way you put this issue is that it's another example of the majority on this Supreme Court to favor businesses, favor the employer. And that's a very broad statement on my part to say that. But nevertheless, we see decision after decision after decision come out from this court in which they do favor the business side of the, or the employer or the corporation side of the issue. On this particular one, it's a social issue too, and it's a health issue, of course. So my concern is how can you overcome that once the decision is made? Probably not for a period of time, but I think that we're looking, and it may be that other cases will go up on the same type of issue that will have some bearing ultimately on the court perhaps changing that position. And the more education in terms of why the use of medical marijuana is important to permit that use will make a difference. If the public becomes concerned, then we may see a change. But unfortunately, for the time being, we're probably stuck with that decision.
Well, there actually seems to be a certain note of anarchy coming from the court when they say, we don't care what the law is, we're going to do what we want if we don't happen to like the law that was passed.
Well, I'm not sure I'd call it anarchy. I would call it sort of a going backwards sort of attitude, that we want to go back before all of these things became problems for us, became issues for us, and just, you know, draw a hard line, so to speak, between what is proper and what is not proper. And I don't think that that's the proper way to decide these cases. But that's my opinion, and other judges have different opinions.
Thank you, Joe, for your call. We're going to have to move on because we have some other callers, but thanks for raising some very pertinent points there. And again, we're talking with Justice Betty Roberts, and want to give us a call, join us in the conversation. Give us a call, dial in at 503-231-8187. We have Will on the line. Good morning, Will.
Good morning, and thank you, Justice Roberts, for coming on the show. Respectfully, I must correct your quotation of the 10th Amendment. It reads, the powers not delegated to the United States by the Constitution or prohibited by the states are reserved to the states, respectively, and most importantly, and you neglected to mention, or to the people. Now, this brings me to my point. I've had a number of occasions to witness a number of docket calls and such, and not in the district courts of Multnomah County. And the question that came to mind after them in my mind was, do they issue the God complex to the judges before they take the bench, or are they people who are just born with the God complex? And my question for you is, don't you think that the judiciary in the United States is the last vestige of feudalism and ought to somehow be a little more democratically evolved? I understand that the code of judicial conduct requires judges to speak respectfully to people. And I saw just a whole lot of what I considered abusive condescension and basically constantly talking down to people as if they were ignorant and somehow a lesser form of citizen than a exalted judge. What is your feelings about all this?
Well, I think you're using this term God complex in saying that judges assume they have too much power. I mean, they assume power. They assume the position. So they this power that they get as a judge sort of goes to their head, and they think they're that somehow or other they can dictate what the rules are for everybody. I suppose there are some judges who might feel that way. I don't. I've not worked with any who feel that way. We feel the ones I've worked with feel very humble to a certain degree about their work and want to get it right. They want to get it right from the standpoint of the law, and they want to get it right in a moral sense. But I don't believe that the Supreme Court decisions represent our move toward anarchy. That would be no government at all. And certainly those judges want to keep government because they're part of it. So, you know, you and I could have a good philosophical debate on some of the terms that you were using and what you were expressing. But I would have to disagree with you that certainly the judges of today who are coming from a much wider experience and serving the people from more of their own experience and their own attitudes about society are not what you're calling the God complex. They don't have that.
Well, I'm sure, Justice Roberts, that you're not that kind of judge that I'm talking about. And please don't take personal.
Oh no, I didn't.
I'm just talking about my observations, and to clue you in, I've practiced law for 30 years, and I've seen a number of judges in a number of jurisdictions, and quite frankly, I'm just not impressed with Multnomah County courts and our district courts as really having truly humble people. They all strike me as being of large firm pedigree.
Oh, that's your truth. That's
true.
They're
not initially elected, so they have to come from some sort of a connected standpoint to get where they're at. And maybe there are some actually, right. I think I did meet one nice one. But I witnessed a whole lot of judges who I consider just downright rude to people.
There's no point in that. But you're talking about the federal district court here,
talking about Multnomah district.
The circuit court.
Circuit courts.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Okay.
My apologies.
Yeah.
My apologies.
That's all right.
Federal judges, I guess, are entitled to have God complexes or some such things. They're appointed for life, and we can't do anything about it. But there's some pretense of democracy involved in the circuit courts, and so I'm just making a plea for a little more civility on the part of the bench. I'll take your comments offline now.
Well, I think he does raise the point he raised. Actually, you were addressing it somewhat earlier when we were talking a little bit about making the bench reflect society more, which means, for one,
true.
It should
yes.
not all be somewhat privileged white males in their middle ages, in the middle age, sitting on the bench, and it should, in fact, you know, reflect the experiences of society.
Well, I don't want to leave the impression with this caller or with anyone that all judges, mm-hmm. are nice people. We get them from all walks of life, and we have a judicial fitness commission that sometimes sanctions judges but a complaint has to be filed. They've even been removed from the bench for violation of judicial ethics. There's an attempt to get cameras in the courtroom, and we do have them in our Oregon courts, so that perhaps will make judges who attempt to be dominating and who attempt to be short-tempered and don't display good judicial temperament to improve their behavior.
What's your take on cameras in the courtroom? Do you think that is an effective tool, or
does
everybody start playing to the camera?
No. And that was the idea at first, that everybody would play to the cameras. That hasn't happened. And we have it in our courts. I doubt that very many citizens watch. It gets on some C-SPAN someplace,
mm-hmm.
and we have it at the Supreme Court. If anybody wants to watch it, you have to stay up pretty late at night to see it. And it's generally just ho-hum, run-of-the-mill lawyers talking to the judges and the judges asking questions. But the U.S. Supreme Court doesn't allow cameras in the courtroom. And there is a movement to try to convince the court that they should. I think at that level, it would be very important to hear the exchange between the judges and the lawyers and to actually hear what the lawyers, what these cases are saying. People from all over the country then would have access to that, and they could see the court actually in operation. I think there are a lot of reasons. Education of the public, to get the judiciary to be more responsible to the public in their behavior, and certainly the way they conduct their trials or their appellate procedure. And so I favor it.
If you just tuned in, we're talking with Oregon Supreme Court Justice Betty Roberts. Joanne is off today, but we'll be back next week. And we're going to go back to the phone lines here in just a moment, but I want to remind you why you need to keep that dial at 90.7 FM, or if you're listening online, you're at kbo.fm. Because at 9, it's Press Watch, the news you're not supposed to know with Teresa Mitchell. At 9:30, Per Fagering speaks with Tom Engelhart, creator of TomDispatch.com website. They discuss Tom's recent article on America's use of pilotless drones. At 10, it's Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre and Liam Delta. At 10:15 on Flashpoints, a report from a Louisiana coast resident on what might happen there as the hurricane season approaches. A report from the International Indigenous Women's Symposium on Reproductive Health and Community Business with Catherine Austin Fitz. And at 11 on Between the Covers, host Ed Goldberg interviews Diane Hammond, author of Seeing Stars, a satirical look at children seeking fame in Hollywood. And at 11:30 on Black Book Talk, the guest is children's author Renee Watson, who will discuss her two newly released books, What Mama Taught Me and A Place Where Hurricanes Happen, a tale of Katrina as children saw it. All that coming up this morning on KBOO. Well, we're going to go back to the phone lines again because we have some more callers, and we have Mark on the line. Good morning. Mark.
It's Bart.
Sorry, Bart. I will get it right eventually, but you're on the line.
Thank you, Justice Roberts. It's refreshing to hear you here, and
thank you.
I thank you for your service to the state and the country. I've got a couple hot potatoes for you. Corporate personhood. The Supreme Court U.S. has recently said that corporations can spend unlimited money or donate unlimited money to any campaign they choose, largely. And that seems inherently wrong, and I think that you may be well aware that the original decision granting corporate personhood, quote-unquote, was not what the decision was by the court, but was written up by the clerk of the court and has maintained itself as a judicial precedent based on the summary that was put into the law books. And also, I would wonder if we could get a comment on the local U.S. Ninth Circuit Court judge whose name escapes me briefly, but who was responsible for the torture memos for the Bush administration. And there's a small but vocal movement to try and get him impeached and tossed off of the court for that, in that that seems to be reprehensible and illegal behavior. And I'll just listen on the air, and thank you for your time. Good day.
Thank you, Bart. Was that Wu who was the...
I'm not sure. I'm not sure. Let me speak to the first one about the United Citizens case. For business reasons and legal reasons, the court has, the statutes do provide that corporations are a person. From liability standpoint and so on, that's significant to them. And also for the way they operate and the way they are able to expand and the formation of their organization. To extend that to a speech issue seems to me not correct. Not correct from the standpoint that it had originally had limited use, and to expand it then to say this is a person who can speak, makes me feel that as a person, I don't have as much authority as a corporation does that has much more money to spend on political campaigns and can be much more influential. And I think that's the general feeling of the public, that how can individuals then have their voice heard if, in fact, it's going to be that corporations are going to be equal in to them. So, you know, it can be a personal thing, it can be a business thing, it can be a political thing in terms of this, of that issue. I believe that the decision was wrong, but we're stuck with it for now, and we'll have to see how it operates. It may be that there will be some changes by Congress. Congress might override that decision in some way, although I suspect that there are plenty of people in Congress who like the decision because they're the ones who get the benefit of the contributions. So it's a difficult issue right now. On the judge on the Ninth Circuit, I can't speak to that because I'm not well informed on it.
However, our engineer, who is the source of so much knowledge here at KBOO, informs us that his name is John Yu.
Oh,
so,
okay.
But at any rate, we're going to go back to the phone lines here in just a second. But we have a lot of people who I think this may speak to the fact that folks do feel somewhat disconnected from our judiciary, because we get you on and we got folks wanting to ask the legal questions. And I certainly want to spend a little bit of time talking about the other aspects of your experience, which you talk about in your book. But and in particular, again, you know, I mean, one of the things, again, looking through this, was that a reminder to folks of what the environment was like for people like you. It's your point in time. I mean, you grew up during the Depression, and, you know, as you were beginning to really start your professional career, the world was changing, but it hadn't really, I mean, there were a lot of barriers there as a woman.
Well, when I went back to school at age 32 to get my degree, college degree, it was not acceptable for a woman to be out of the home doing something like that, working or going to school or having any other activity to speak of. And so, yes, I went through that phase and then went through the 60s with the Civil Rights Movement and later the Peace Movement and then the Women's Movement. It was a really quite a social revolutionary time in which almost everybody that I knew and worked with or associated with or was in politics were out there with a cause or multiple causes. And that was the period, of course, that young people were taking the lead in most all of those issues. And there were some unsettling things, riots in the cities, shooting of students in Wisconsin at the college, at the university there for peace demonstrations. Just an extensive period of time that the country seemed to be in turmoil. The assassination of Robert Kennedy, the assassination of Martin Luther King, that was a period of time that was pretty dark days. So, and we had to work through them, and we've come out, I think, in Oregon, at least we came out, with also a revolution in legislation. When we protected the beaches to make them public, when land use was first begun in the state of Oregon in 1971, and 73, both sessions were the big issues, were the big sessions on land use. And of course, my book concentrates very much on the women's movement and all the legislation that had to be passed. It was just basic legislation so that women could get credit without having a man sign on the credit application as well. When a woman, we had to pass legislation to allow a woman to keep her name up on her family name, her surname, her birth name, upon marriage or return to a name upon getting a divorce, which is just accepted today. Women were not admitted to trade schools. There was just endless legal restrictions on women. More restrictions just by imposition of society, the conformity, the confinement of women to the home. So the title, With Grit and by Grace, the grit part is the hard work and the determination that many demonstrated during that period of time, and certainly I did, in overcoming rejections. You can't do this, you should not do that, I won't let you do this, that came to me constantly. And the grace part is about those who supported me, gave me encouragement, sometimes mentor, certainly role models. I've tried to demonstrate in the book that along with just the facts, the historical facts, and my own personal experiences, that there are a lot of messages that we can get from these experiences, that we can learn how to take rejection and overcome that and then go on to be successful, that we need to learn more about recognizing opportunities when they come our way and take advantage of them. We need to be bolder, take risk, but carefully thought out risk in order to move on. And certainly these are messages for women today and for minorities, but I think for everyone in our society, that we all face these obstacles. And how do we deal with them without turning inside and saying, I'll never be able to do this, so I won't do it? You have to overcome it in order to go on.
Well, I wish we had about another 2 hours to go here. Unfortunately, we don't, but I am going to try to squeeze one more caller in because they've been patiently waiting. So, Dave, you're on the line, but I'm going to ask you to keep it short and to the point.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning, Justice Roberts.
Good morning to you.
How are you today? I do have a question in regards to your recent comment about the women's movement, and I have seen studies over the past 15, 20 years that say that the breakdown of the family is a large part of a fatherless generation and mothers working outside the home. It used to be that when mothers were at home taking care of their families, that we had a lot better families and less trouble in society, and now that the women's movement has somewhat destroyed the family.
Okay, Dave, I'm going to have to cut you off here because we don't have much time. I'm going to let Justice Roberts make a brief comment, though. You're opening up a whole subject that, you know, at this point in the program, we don't have the time to address. But thank you for calling in, and would you like to have a ending comment on this?
Yes. Well, obviously, I have some strong feelings about this because I was a mother of four children. Still a mother of four children, as a matter of fact. And when they got in school, I went back to school. And they tell me constantly that they didn't think anything about it. I went to school and taught school for the next 10 years, and while they went to school for the next 10 years and more. And we all just, we got along fine. It did cause a divorce in the family because he told me I couldn't teach and just flatly said, you stay home with the kids. And so I was denied that opportunity to become a producing member of society, as well as being a good mother. So I don't buy this business that if women stayed home, that we wouldn't have all the problems we have today. We see many women who stay at home with their children, and they don't turn out so well sometimes. So it's a matter just of being sure that every person in society can reach their potential, can decide their own destiny, and can help a society in any way they can.
Well, That's a great closing note for the program. I want to thank you so much for spending the hour with me here this morning. It's, as I said before, I wish we had another hour to go. This is Dave Mazza. We've been talking with Oregon Supreme Court Justice Betty Roberts about her new book, With Grit and By Grace. You can go to kboo.fm/voicesfromtheedge to download the podcast of this conversation, as well as getting some links about the book. I want to thank you for tuning in and all the great questions, and you have a good day. We'll see you at the same time next week. Get up, stand up. Don't give up the fight.